Hello, this is Ray Brooks.
Hey, this is Big Lou. That's double L-O-U.
Hi, I'm Veronica Jackson.
Hey, everybody, this is Adam Gusso.
I'm Dietra Farr.
Hey there, folks. This is Don Flynn of the American Songsters, slapping the death with Jack Dapper.
Hi, this is Guy Davis.
Hi, I'm Shamika Copeland.
Hey, I'm Ben Turner of Piedmont Blues. I'm here with Valerie Turner.
And we are bluesing with Lamont Jack Burley.
Hi, I'm Larry Griffin, and I keep it locked and loaded on Jack Dapper Blues. Yes, yes, yes.
From 1840 to 1890, minstrel shows were the most popular form of entertainment in America. And it derives from two characters that were birthed within 4 years of each other. One, Jim Crow, created by Thomas Dartmouth Daddy Rice in 1830, and the other, the Zip Coon, first performed by George Dixon in 1834. One was based on a character by a white actor slash dancer who blackened his face with burnt cork and danced a jig while singing the lyrics to the song Jump Jim Crow, and the other made mockery of free blacks who were portrayed as arrogant, ostentatious figures who dressed in high style and spoke in a series of malaprops and puns that undermines their attempts to appear dignified. Both of these characters would soon merge to make the coon, which has become a stain on the image of African Americans. However, at the same time, it was a catalyst for the successful careers of many African Americans at the turn of the century. Today, I speak with Dom Flemings, the American songster, about the history of blackface and minstrelsy in regard to early black music and entertainment and its effect today.
First of all, welcome again, Dom, to Jack Dapper Blues.
Well, Jack Dapper, thank you again for having me, man. It's always a pleasure.
Yes, it really is. As you always say, there's a lot to unpack. I would like to read this excerpt, though, before we get into it. It was written in the Indianapolis Freeman, a black newspaper, by a writer called Tom the Tattler, okay, in 1901. I want you to dive into this excerpt first, because this kind of says it all. Again, 1901, he penned this for the Indianapolis Freeman black newspaper. And the quote goes as this: "The colored man writes the coon song. The colored singers sing the coon song. The colored race is compelled to stand for the belittling and ignominy of the coon song. But the money from the coon song flows with ceaselessness, activity into the white man's pocket." Can we unpack that first?
Well, I mean, one thing I would mention is just look at the reflection of all the different eras of entertainment in the United States, and you'll see different versions of this very argument and story coming up. And I think in the 1890s, it was no different. But one thing we have to think about, though, is that when you're in an era before recorded music being available, everything had to be seen in the live performance. And the live performances became so bombastic over a period of time that it had to break itself down and turn into something new, which is what happened in the recorded music era. So I think that in the context of its time, I mean, you have very wealthy white proprietors that are paying for the productions that people like Burt Williams and George Walker are doing. But then at the same time, you have these same performers turning around and creating a benevolent society called the Frogs, in which they tried to elevate the Negro in the arts, and they created the template and the foundation for what would become the Harlem Renaissance. So it's a very nuanced conversation going on. I guess, of course, in the context of the blues is a folk music, and the blues incorporated itself into the black vaudeville world in the early 1900s, and it ultimately superseded vaudeville, and it really put the last nail in the coffin for blackface minstrelsy in a certain regard. It really makes the blues even more phenomenal as a musical genre than fans of the blues even know.
Right. As I like to preach, the blues was the actual first freed expression for a freed group of black folk. And I guess what you just said heightened that to the next level. Now, you said a whole lot, but before we go into the latter part of that, you mentioned something early on we can go into first, actually, Williams and Walker, because it is said that Williams and Walker was a direct product of African-American migration from the rural South to the Northeast, right? And they kind of created, or not necessarily created, but they, through their art, polarized this new Negro scene. How important were they, and how did they actually infiltrate Broadway?
All right. Well, now this is an even more interesting story. Now, so since this is an African-American program, I should mention that George Walker was from the South, but Burt Williams was from Nassau, and he came over and lived in San Francisco, and the two of them started working together on the vaudeville circuit in the circus shows in San Francisco during the
West. So wait, Nassau in the West Indies?
Yeah, so Burt Williams is a West Indian man. That what ended up happening is that Williams and Walker saw some of the old minstrel shows at that time. You know, there was just the still same plantation slave archetype. And they just said, this is so out of date, and we really need to modernize the blackface minstrel character. So they created an act that was called the Two Rio Coons. And they were really dapper. They wore like tuxedos and they had kind of the big guy, little guy comedy routine, and they both sang. And George Walker then died unexpectedly at a young age. And then Burt Williams made recordings and became a big recording star up until about 1920, to the era of Mamie Smith recording the Crazy Blues. So he's like in the background this whole time. But for those two guys, they then saw these Dahomian Africans that were at the World Exposition Fair, and they thought to themselves, we should delineate our own characters based on these Africans we've met here. And they created a show called Sons of Ham, and then another one called In Dahomey. And there was another one that Abyssinia was the other one, they covered themes of African kingdoms in a musical comedy form, and it became huge on Broadway. And they created the Frogs after that because they had made enough money to make these big Broadway shows. And within the Frogs, they worked with James Rosamund Johnson, who worked with a guy named Bob Cole, who was also in the Frogs. They made the first colored Broadway musical called A Trip to Coontown. And they worked with Williams and Walker. And then they worked with James Reese Europe, who was the famous band leader, ragtime banjo orchestra leader from Harlem, who also was a World War I veteran. And James Reese Europe had these two proteges, Noble Sissel and UB Blake.
Right.
So James Reese Europe died very unexpectedly in a murder, and UB Blake and Noble Sissel championed his cause to create a African American vernacular Broadway form, and they created the song Shuffle. They made the show Shuffle Along as a result of that. And so it's this really long timeline of black vaudeville that links back into blackface minstrelsy, but it evolves into this whole other African-American art form. But again, it's in the context of theater, and that's something to really keep in mind with everything said and done. People were thinking of this as a style and something that they did to create a character. And as while it may not make sense to us in modern day context, this is just what people did. And so it's a very interesting, complex, very strange history too.
It is. And what I find interesting is what you just shared with us almost reflects the statement that I'm about to read to you that I came across. It says that after the Civil War, the function of the blackface characters were meant to be authentic, an authentic representation of African Americans instead of the carnivalesque mask that it started out to be. So I think this is a good time to backtrack and kind of give the origin and how these things kind of came together, right? Because we have a couple of things going on. We have the beginning of blackface, which was Thomas Daddy Rice, right?
That's right. With
Jim Crow. And then a couple of years later, we have the Zip Coon. And somewhere these things merged and made a lane for black music and entertainment. Can you unpack that for us?
Oh, sure. Well, this is the sort of odd part about it, because it turns into this interesting story of American popular culture as seen through the theater. So in England, they have a style of performance art called music hall, which is like basically you have an actor who creates a character. Like there's a guy named George Laybourne, and he had a song called Champagne Charlie Is My Name, which people that are fans of Blind Blake would know that he recorded that song. But Champagne Charlie was his character. So it was George Laybourne as Champagne Charlie. And then he sang all these songs as Champagne Charlie. And that's part of the music hall art form. And so breaking away from that European antecedent, in America, we developed our own type of folksy, American crass, musical theater form. And Blackface Minstrelsy was a part of it. And of course, in New York City, between, the years after the Civil War leading into the early 1900s, First World War, even Second World War, the population of immigrants of every different ethnicity is overwhelming. So musical theater took on all of these ethnic groups and sort of did their own sort of crass, stereotyped musical form. Because at the time, music had to be composed. And so when you get into Blackface Minstrelsy, you're thinking of early American composers composing the vernacular sounds of what they think African-American music is. And so it creates a dichotomy of, is this something that they're really doing, or is this something that the writer said that they're doing? So Blackface Minstrelsy is reverberations of this idea again and again, because and how it fits into African-American music is, of course, you have early African-American music, banjo and fiddle, and you have these early types of instrument being brought over and then mixing together in the rural Southern vernacular music. Then it goes up and it becomes a popular music form. So then it translates over. So like a guy like Daddy Rice, he's an Irish-American guy that is a dancer. And in St. Louis, the story goes, he saw an old stable hand that had this little kind of limp that he did. And then Daddy Rice figured out a dance that mimicked what this guy was doing. And the thing went over so well in the theater that night, in the context of his theatrical play he was doing, he got 30 encores, and people loved the character, the dance, and the song Jump Jim Crow. So he was selling three things at one time. And there was a whole set of archetype blackface characters that were in place. By the time we get to the end of the Civil War, it's such a well-known form of entertainment. It's like, think of like, to get really silly, think of a show like The Simpsons. You know, there's
right.
there's a mother, a father, a daughter, a son, and a baby. And they just do wacky things. So by the time you get to the end of the Civil War, the archetypes are set in place. So when African Americans want to get into entertainment, they just have to learn how to be Jim Crow or Zip Coon, or they know how to play this character or Tambo or Mr. Bones. And they learn those theatrical forms. And then over time you find slowly and steadily they evolve and they make their own African American version of it. Even with the minstrels, the Virginia minstrels usually meant a white group. Georgia minstrels usually meant a black group. So when you think of like the Fish Jubilee singers, the first time they're out performing, people are like, wow, this is the weirdest minstrelsy we've ever seen, because they had been so used to African-American minstrelsy that to see these people dressed in suits and doing very lovely classical spirituals was something that was a novelty, because it was just so different. And so it led to a snowballing of people saying, we want to see the real thing. What's the real thing? What's the real African-American music? And it reverberates in that way, which is why African-Americans by the 1890s, after Reconstruction and all the different stuff that went on up since the Civil War to the 1900s, the music reflects that. So then you have urban blacks that are up to date, ragtime people, because ragtime is the musical accompaniment to coon songs. So
right.
Ragtime is basically they take out all the words and ragtime becomes its own musical phenomenon. And that's a part of this bigger story. And of course, when it comes to the blues, we get to the vernacular versions of the blackface minstrel shows that are part of the Deep South, because people in the North don't want to go into the South and tour. And that was true back then, too.
Right.
You had deep Southern traveling minstrel circus shows like W.C. Handy. He was a pit band orchestra for Mahara's Minstrels, which was a blackface minstrel show. But it was like a kind of a classier circus like P.T. Barnum or there's even like the something like the Universal Circus, which is a black circus.
It right.
was, imagine those things being combined in a single place, because in segregated times, that's all you had to go with. And from those circuses, you have people like Ma Rainey come out, and you have people like Lonnie Johnson is a part of that world, Big Joe Williams. And those people were all part of the Southern vaudeville, which also is part of the medicine show world as well. But that's a little bit of the unpacking. Sorry, it's a
no. Part of history. it is. You know, I like how you were able to condense all of that into such a precise statement, because there's quite a few things I would like to tackle out of what you said. Like, for one, according to John W. Fenson, the music that first presented itself as a model for realistic menstrual songs came from black religious songs or black spiritual, so to speak. So it was just kind of ironic that you said that, because I wanted to ask you about that. But
sure.
I want to unpack something else here, because I recently started a series on Charlotte Fortin Grimke, who, as you know, was the very first person to document black spirituals. And one of the things that I found that was, I don't know if it was odd, but it shouldn't be odd, but I think it's something that's rarely discussed. And that's the difference between the educated African-American and the non-educated. Because when she went to St. Helena Island, she found it very difficult to connect with and make a bond with the people of Sea Island, who are just newly free. Now, I say that because of something you just said, and I want to talk about that. The connection between educated blacks and rural non-educated blacks in this minstrel and blackface world. What was that dynamic?
Well, there's a couple of things. One of the things, I'll give an example. A few years ago, I wrote an article for the Oxford American about Gus Cannon. And it was discussing a song called Can You Blame the Colored Man? And the song is a parody of the meeting of Theodore Roosevelt and Booker T. Washington in the White House in 1900. And so this was a big event, but to just kind of sidestep away from that, I learned a lot about Booker T. Washington himself. And one of the things I found that was interesting is when it came to the Black Manifesto, and we all know this, there's a Black Manifesto that is put out there, and we try to teach people parts of that manifesto so that we can understand the bigger history. And I'm so glad that there are so many schools of thought now coming out as we have more access to technology. But basically, you had a period of time where you had people born into slavery and you had people that were born into freedom, and they had two different perspectives of how they wanted the world to evolve and move forward. And you find that reverberating a lot as well, because of, you have a guy like Booker T. Washington, was more of a guy who said, get a trade and really build up where you're standing, while a guy like W.E.B. Du Bois wanted to have more of an intellectual conversation about the rights of equality on the civil rights level. And of course, there was a certain point where Booker T. Washington's manifesto didn't resonate with as many people as it did earlier on, when they were coming straight from slavery saying, great, we got some land, we're going to grow it, we're going to make a city, compared to folks that are saying, well, we're in the city and we'd like to be treated as on the same level. I mean, that's two conversations that it'd be very hard to come to a single conclusion.
Right.
And I think that that happens too when it comes to the music as well. You know, you were either really deeply within the church music or you were deep in the secular music. And I think that those have always gone back and forth. And especially with the minstrel show, with the, you know, you, if you look at Frederick Douglass's thoughts on the minstrel show, he's really appalled by it and he thinks it's a horrible thing.
Right. As well as black spirituals, he wasn't a fan of those as well.
And in a way, I can understand why, in the way that how it's being manufactured and produced out to people, I could see him having a philosophical problem with that, you know. This comes from the perspective of people who were born in slavery and people not born in slavery. And of course, you get to the 1890s, then it's like two generations out of slavery. And when the railroads are in place, people can really get very urbanized very fast in and there's a lot of connection between the old world and the new world happening. And I think that's why the blues had to evolve out of that.
Being able to travel and see and experience different things.
Yeah. You know, there's an interesting book called The Original Blues from Abbott and Saroff. And they've done a great trilogy on stuff. And you mentioned the Indianapolis Freeman.
Right. But
in the third book, they talk about how there was a musician named String Beans. And he was a blues singer who improvised his blues, and it was so real, apparently, that it was it just knocked everybody out every time. But because it was improvised and it was not composed music like everybody else in Black Vaudeville was doing at the time, they were all composers, publishers, performers, and it was a very elaborate system. And String Beans ended up dying very young, unfortunately, as well. And he never made recordings, but he set this precedent for improvised blues. And one of his famous lines is, if anybody asks you who composed this song, just tell him it's Sweet Papa String Beans. He's been here and gone, which is a blues line that resonates again and again as a particular piece of blues vocabulary. And apparently the realness, instead of having to play a character, the realness of the blues, it put the final nail in blackface minstrelsy. And the book kind of ends out where they say, well, we've got nothing left, because they basically, the recording companies came in and recorded all this improvised blues, took all the money, and there was nothing left for Black Vaudeville, you know?
And this is where we see, if I'm not mistaken, the names of the artists, the names of songs, and the context of songs becoming more travel based, right? Like Route 69 or this and the third, or I'm on a, or some type of river, or whatever the case may be.
That's right. Well, that's part of the transportation system. I found that out with jug band music. If you follow, you know, Memphis is connected to Baton Rouge and New Orleans and Mobile, Alabama, and Vicksburg, Mississippi. And from there, you can go to Memphis, Louisville, St. Louis, Chicago, all on a single riverboat. And that's what people did for a long time. Then the trains came in, and then you had all these other towns. That's when, if you look at Highway 61, you can check out the old Yellow Dog, you know, from W.C. Handy. Look up the old railroad lines for that. You'll find Aberdeen there, Pledge, Senatobia, all stops along the same train line. And it's almost like a map of the blues in a way.
Right, because when you said Aberdeen, I thought of Booker White. I thought of Mississippi John Hurt and all the greats that made these songs.
Right.
So now, with this being said, we've touched quite a few things. I want to delve into this gentleman real quick, and then we can get back to blackface and minstrelsy. But during the time that this was still prevalent, or as you say, popular entertainment and employment for black people, because I just want to, before I get into this, I have to stop for the audience to make it very clear. I hope you understood what Brother Dom just said. This was an elaborate system. Though the imagery may have ultimately been disrespectful or received in a negative way, these were trained musicians. They were coming together and they were really, you know, writing out songs note for note. So this was not any ABC 1-2-3 situation. It was very intricate. So it's kind of an oxymoron saying that out loud, but it is. But there is a gentleman that I come across, Andy Razoff, I believe his name is, who mm-hmm. chose not to take that route and still had some sort of, he had a lot of success. Are you familiar with him? Could you unpack the people like him in that time who chose not to go blackface or not to go ragtime and coon song?
Well, you know what's funny about him? See, now with that fellow, Andy Razoff, he was from Madagascar. See, and that's the thing that's a fun, interesting thing to know about him. But there was always a backlash to the more offensive imagery. Like, one of the interesting stories I found was that there was a really offensive song, one called Every Nation Has a Flag But the Coon. And that's rough, right?
That's very rough.
And so Booker T. Washington and Marcus Garvey got together and they incorporated the Pan-African flag because of this song.
Mm.
And so, like, there is definite response to all of the offensive imagery that is happening all along the way. And of course, by the time the Harlem Renaissance really begins to evolve, they are evolving past the old minstrel imagery. But, you know, like when you think of Langston Hughes, he has banjos and countrysides and stuff like that in his imagery, but it all really elevates past the you know, the cabin in the sky, if we want to talk about the movie. And and they just kind of, they evolve into this beautiful, glorious jazz. And that's kind of where the upper echelon went. But we have to remember there's a Southern vernacular music form that evolved out of all these brass bands being around. You know, like when you hear a guy like Charlie Patton, you can tell Charlie Patton went to the old tent shows and saw people like Ma Rainey or Bessie Smith early on, because these women had careers 10 years going by the time the record companies discovered them as new artists. And again, that's a thing we see that in the modern era, where you have musicians that have been around for years, but they finally cut that first major label record and everybody's like, oh my God, overnight success. But, you know, but you're like, well, he'd been doing it 15 years on the street with all the folks that have been supporting him. And Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith and all of them, they came out of that world. Just like Mamie Smith is part of the Harlem cabaret world.
Right.
And so it became like, for a while, the trend was, let's get black women singers. And it was in a response, because remember, like your quote said early on, talking about coon songs were sung by blacks, there was a movement of white singers, white women singers, people like Sophie Tucker, who was the last of the Red Hot Mamas on Broadway. She sang coon songs as a coon shouter, was what they called them.
Right.
And they sang songs like Bully of the Town, which are, I mean, if anybody listens to these songs, they're dropping the N-bombs like there's no tomorrow in some of these coon songs. And it'll knock your socks off to hear a cylinder recording that's speaking this language. But it was done by white women. Mm. And again, if we think of the women's liberation movement and stuff like that, it's also reflective of this particular type of song with ragtime. So Sophie Tucker was doing that. And at first, the blues divas were known as coon shouters as well. But over time, they just turned it into blues diva and just made it a whole other style of music. And so then that evolved into its own thing. But the translation of this theater art form with the pit orchestras, changing them into jazz and improvised orchestras with people like Louis Armstrong and Kid Ory, King Oliver,
right,
Jelly Roll Morton. Now we're getting a whole new world of what black vaudeville is and what it became, you see. And so the blues is still the vernacular music that was there beforehand, and it was there afterward. And you know, a lot of the black string bands, like the Mississippi Sheiks, they do, they got a song called, what is it called? The Mysterious Coon.
Right.
That's one from the first black musical, A Trip to Coontown by Bob Cole, one of the Frogs. That's one of his songs. And so they record that in their repertoire, along with Fiddle Breakdowns, as well as Sitting on Top of the World, and see as a group that understands that black
vernacular music is multiple things. They recorded a lot of different types of material. And of course, it translates over into blues and jazz and that gospel music as well.
Right. So would you consider Pick Poor Robin Clean by Geechee Wiley and I can't think of the other sister's name, but that would be considered a coon song based on the commentary of the lyrics?
It would definitely be in that vein. That one's kind of a combination of both the formal song and a vernacular version of it, because it has a combination of both of those forms. And that's what happens too. It's like any type of popular music, once it goes out there, it reverberates in the rural communities, and so you find these very interesting evolutions of the song forms coming through within the early recorded music, especially when we get into the late 20s and the early 30s, where you have a lot of rural performers that are performing their own original songs, or sometimes pulling out these older songs from the Black Vaudeville era, like Bo Carter has the one Turnip Greens.
Right.
That's another one that's connected to Cow Cow Davenport, who is a famous ragtime piano player, blues singer, as well as a vaudevillian. So it has these very interesting reverberations that come through all across this particular genre. But again, it's very, very multifaceted. It covers so much ground, because there's a northern version and a southern version, and then they even reverberate each maybe 5-10 years, you know.
Yeah, I do. As I listen to you break this down, I think of the rap version of hip hop, because the rap version is the actual vernacular of the people. And I think about the reality of how the lyrics evolved from one thing to another, and the reality of the people's communities become prevalent in the songs, and then in all genres of African American music of current, the last 10 to 20 years, you see this reflection. So when you broke that down, that's kind of what was going through my head. Now, man, you've unpacked quite a few things, which is very good. I would like to discuss, because, I mean, you are the American Songster.
Oh, yeah.
So now we know that early songsters, there was not necessarily a format. Right. That these guys would do like 20-minute songs, you know, at what point, because a lot of some of those guys went on to be involved in this particular entertainment business. Right. So at what point did it go from, you know, on a porch or at some sort of shindig, corn diddy or whatever, where they're just playing for people to either dance or to be amused or entertained, to actually making a format out of these tunes to fit not the narrative of the blackface or whatever, but fit the narrative of the actual show, right?
So well, it's an interesting thing especially when it comes to this particular era with like the coon songs, for example. Like I'll give you a perfect example. Like a guy like Frank Stokes, who was out of Memphis.
Right.
There are several songs that he does within his recorded repertoire that are coon songs in essence, like Chicken That Couldn't Crow Behind the Moon, as well as I Got Mine, It's a Good Thing, We Shall Be Free. These are songs that all reference back to the minstrel show, but in the form that Frank Stokes does them, he's taken all of the imagery that was buffoonery and he has transformed it into black ingenuity and excellency. So like I Got Mine is really, again, it's another one that's dropping the N-bombs like there's no tomorrow. But in Frank Stokes' version, he takes all the offensive words out, and then the I Got Mine is him getting ahead in every situation. So these songs, how they were written, it was based on the audience. It fed into the stereotypes with a certain audience, but it fed into the good stereotypes for another set of the audience without changing a single word. And that was how a lot of that material was created. It could be kind of like a lot, you know, I don't know, like if you think of like where they have a lot of jokes for the adults, but the kids don't get it. These songs are written in that way where the black audience would think one thing and then the white audience would think of another way. And a guy like Frank Stokes really works it very well to really play to a black audience, a very strong message of like, hey, you know, we've got obstacles, but we're going to get past them. Like, you know, guys like that. Gus Cannon's another one that does that. His song, My Money Never Runs Out. The two songs that he used, which is one called I Don't Care If I Never Wake Up, which is about a guy that smokes opium. And he changes it into this song about being the best he can be. And it's really interesting the way that you have this transition happen. There's another article I saw from Bob Cole. In 1909, he actually put a call out through the community, I think through the Chicago Defender or the Indianapolis Freeman, one of those. And he said he apologized for having tried to cash in so much on coon songs. Mm. And he was encouraging everyone to stop using the word because it's gotten so bad on the street that we really have to stop using that word in our songs. And so it was interesting to know that there was even, they did it. Then after 10 years, they felt bad about it. And then they came back and said, you shouldn't do that. But the songs still reverberate within the community. You know, and that's the power of a strong song as well.
It is. I would like, you keep doing this and it's great. Because in the coon song, at the turn of the century, this was considered, or actually even before the turn of the century, right? We could say 1880s to 1900, this was considered a great innovation by African-American musicians, the coon songs. However, yeah. At the turn of the century, racism was intentionally used through coon songs because of fear of whites, that African Americans were migrating from rural into their areas, particularly the North. Could you unpack that? Because based on what you just said, it sounds like a group of these artists understood the impacts of these things.
Absolutely. And that's what that was what they were working with as well. And it gets really odd it really seems very odd until you start to look at the individual lives of these performers. Like a guy like, you know, Burt Williams worked with guys like Will Marion Cook, who was like a classical musician who, because he couldn't get the positions he wanted within legitimate opera, he went to writing coon songs. But he was writing harmonically interesting, harmonically different compositions within the coon song formula. And so you find that's a part of this story as well. And it's very, very peculiar. Again, but this is a world before you had recorded music. And so all music had to be heard live. And that's something that makes it very different than anything we could even imagine today. You know?
Yes.
And so that's kind of where all that stuff fits, you know. But the blues is a very interesting thing. Like I mentioned the guy String Beans, he had a protege, and Butterbeans and Susie were his proteges. So they're kind of a holdover to this guy String Beans from Black Vaudeville, but they're like a husband and wife, a vaudeville comedy duo, kind of like I don't know, like George and Wheezy from the Jeffersons. It's like an older version of that. But that was a big thing, too, is husband and wife, black vaudeville teams. And kind of like, somewhere between like kind of like the Jeffersons, where they're always kind of bickering with each other in song. Or like,
right.
You know, that's a part of it, too. Moms Mabley comes from this world.
Yes, she does.
Rudy Ray Moore.
Man, Rudy Ray Moore was he was a brilliant businessman, if nothing else. Now, I want to ask you this question, because we've kind of encapsulated all of these things into this conversation so far. So I would like to know, based on all this information, what does this say about black folk, black musical expressions? And I mean, the blues specifically, but we can incorporate all African-American traditional musics.
Well, I mean, I think the most powerful thing is that in spite of the obstacles, there are so many amazing contributions that have been made by African-American people since the very beginning. And that's something to just, I think, even to just sit and meditate on that for just one moment is very powerful in and of itself. And especially if you're a big fan of the blues and understand all of the history that is encapsulated within this music, or you think of country music and old time music that have their roots in African American culture and African-American roots and African roots, Caribbean roots, the whole thing, just to be able to sit and think on how powerful this music has been for not just the people in the United States, but all over the world. I mean, it's really something.
Well, yeah. And I'll say, since you mentioned international success, Blackface was an international success in the 1800s.
Exactly.
Right. So please unpack this, because it's believed by some music scholars that Blackface gave actors and dancers the ability to make socially relevant statements against the system in a less intrusive way. What's your take on that?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the same sort of reverberations we see within jazz history. You know, like when Billie Holiday first sang Strange Fruit, or when Nina Simone sang Mississippi Goddamn. These were songs that changed the course of these women's careers, because they took it there. And yes, it changed the whole thing. But that it was also, again, think of the people who wrote it. They didn't write the songs. These were progressives that were writing these songs for these women, too. So it was a combined effort in composition, in terms of social statements and movements. So that's in the legitimate world of music. But when we think of folk music, that's where people like Alan Lomax and John Lomax and John Work III come into it, because they're saying, see, these popular musicians, they're presenting this form of the story. But look, there's this other form of the story that we know exists. Here is our documentation to prove it. And that's why you have folk music and its documentation taking place around the same time, early 1930s, because they're seeing a change with technology coming in. Again, now this is where the 21st century relevance comes in. The technology is coming in. It's changing things and telling stories in a certain way. And now here are these other schools of thoughts that have to come up in defense to show that they exist, because without the technology would just wipe us all out, or at least in theory it would just wipe us out. But that's part of where you have this give and take, this push and pull of what's real folk music and what's popular, the popularization of folk music and the popular version of it, if you will. And there's no right answer, minstrelsy takes you there though.
No, it does. And bringing up folk music, I would like you to incorporate someone who's considered like the king or the godfather of folk music, Lead Belly, because he's sung a lot of coon songs.
That's right. Within his repertoire, again, we have to think of it as a broad repertoire and it being one type of song within this bigger repertoire. And Lead Belly, again, he's collecting songs just like any of us listening to songs. We don't have a single song we would necessarily go to if we knew all these other songs. And Lead Belly took in songs like that and presented them. Again, his story has it tiptoes along the line, because he would spend time in Harlem, but they didn't like his accent because he spoke in a thick Southern accent. At the same time, when John Lomax came and told this incredible story of this musician, the New York Times, they published it as, you know, murderer sings a couple of songs between homicides. And so the media had a lot of that backlog of racism still within, because, you know, it's only 20, 30 years before that was when Jack Johnson became the heavyweight champion. So this is, you know, people are not used to this sort of type of music. But Lead Belly, again, he's singing not just coon songs, but Skip to My Lou, Midnight Special. He's singing something, a little bit of something for everybody. And that's what always drew me into the songsters in general, which is part of what I find so intriguing, is a lot of the early songsters from the 20s and 30s, they have songs in their repertoire that lead into these earlier periods of music. And it's fascinating to be able to see what things stuck and what things just got passed by, you know?
Yeah, so because what I'm receiving, and I have to say I'm in agreement, this is such a complex, world, for lack of a better term, that majority of people are really misinformed or maybe not misinformed, but receiving the impact and complexity of this world totally different than what it actually really is.
Absolutely. And that's part of the interesting thing that I've found overall is especially when I started to realize that many of the early recording artists that I guess thinking of how we think of recording artists now, you'd think most people were playing material that's relevant to the exact moment that they recorded it. But to think that people recorded songs back then that could reference back to 30 to 50 years previous is something that I don't think that most of us would ever have considered being a part of commercial popular music, at least in the way that we see it in the modern era. And so we're finding that. But at the same time, in the world of streaming, you're also finding that, too. People are just recording stuff and throwing it out there. They're making the 78s of their time where maybe one obscure artist might have this interesting song that catches on and that's their 178 recording.
Right. Well, you know, with that being said, because now there's a couple of things we have to unpack, because we were speaking about it in regards to music, Broadway, but this menstrual world had a real impact on pop culture as a whole, right? Because now let's break down the players in this, right? Now, we already spoke about Jim Crow and Zip Coon, right? And then they became one as just the Coon. Then we had the Mammy. We had the Uncle Tom. We had Buck. Mm-hmm. We had the Bedwench Jezebel. We had the Mulatto. And we had the Pickaninnies.
Yeah.
Right? So now we fast forward to even now, the last 20, 30, 40 years, we see many... Up until today, we see many renditions of these characters in music, television, film, and we see our local and state senators and politicians taking part in this blackface, in their case, fiasco. How would you unpack that? Because we're looking at something that's a two-sided coin here.
Yeah, well, it's really tricky with those particular parts of the culture, because we have to think of it. Again, Southern culture has a lot of contradictory points in it. But one of the things is that there's a pride in the culture in of itself. And that's where you have something like the Blackface Minstrel Show. As it evolved, it became an international phenomenon. That's why I mentioned theater, because when there was a circuit for international performance through the music hall circuit that would take you as far as Japan or Australia, also all over the world. And these blackface minstrel performers jumped on these circuits and played all over the world. And so that's a piece of popular culture that if you were someone in a foreign country and you happened to see a minstrel show, you would think that was American culture just by your one chance of seeing this show. And so that's one of the ways that reverberated as an international phenomenon, because then people wanted to play the banjo. They wanted to play the fiddle, the bones, and the tambourine. And they made books, method books, to play all of these instruments and to do your own minstrel shows and everything. There was a whole instruction booklet. It was a whole thing. But it's from that culture, you still have it reverberating out, and it's something that is in a lot of people's a past, you know, especially in the South. It's just a part of the culture. And, you know, and we have to think, like, you know, it wasn't until the early 80s that people were really trying to even do political correctness. This is why they tried to bring political correctness into it, because, you know, there was a lot of bad blood and a lot of bad words being used by a lot of people constantly. And, you know, we haven't really gotten past that era. And that's the thing that, to me, we haven't really gotten past that era of culture. And that's really something that should be considered, at least in the big thing. It doesn't really make any of it right. But, you know, but in the world around Appomattox, Virginia, there's a strong connection to both the end of the Civil War, as well as Joe Walker Sweeney, who was one of the guys to bring the African derived banjo into the Blackface Minstrel Show and change the form, because then banjo players were in demand. So you had one step at a time. You had each individual performer learning an instrument. First, they were just dancers and bones players. Then it was singular instrumentalists. And then you had the Virginia Minstrels, which is the first four-person minstrel show, a whole night of minstrel shows. And then by the time you get into the bigger minstrel shows, just to unpack the theater for folks, I know this is a little technical, but the minstrel shows are broken into three parts. And it's the olio, which is the intro where everybody shows off a little bit of a feature. You have the soloist section, the olio. Yeah, you have the fanfare, which is the big opening. The olio, which is the specialized. So if someone has a special song they did by themselves, this is the time you'd see everybody doing, you know, like Emmett Miller, the blackface performer. He did the clarinet voiced yodel. And so that was like his specialty. Then the third part would be a theater production, usually of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Right.
And what ends up happening, too, at first they played straight Uncle Tom's Cabin, but then after a couple of decades, it just became comedy Uncle Tom's Cabin, which then created a series of archetypes, which you're talking about the Mammy and Uncle Tom, Legree, Liza, the Pickaninnies, and Topsy. All that stuff comes from this Uncle Tom's Cabin section of the minstrel show, which is a single section of the show. Vaudeville is born out of just taking the olio out, and then everybody did vaudeville. So it was only the specialist entertainment field. So when you see the old Bugs Bunny cartoons were at the vaudeville theater, that's based out of the minstrel show. So there's always a touch of minstrel show within that popular form of theater. So that's one of the reasons we see it reverberate again and again and again, because it's so ingrained as one element. It's like, you know, it's like electric.
Like Soul Plane?
Yeah. Think of like a rock band, you know, like a rock band with the leotard. They have the guitars. And then you can even think of
Saturday Night Live.
Or like hip hop. There's a part of hip hop that has disco in it because of the drum machines.
Right.
And if you take the disco out of it and you use like real drums, something gets lost in the old school rap, because it's really all about having that Casio and two turntables instead of having a real drummer. You know, there's a certain aesthetic quality that's a part of it. But anyway, that's how vaudeville, the minstrel show is just this one aesthetic quality that remained a part of it. And so, of course, you had big minstrel shows that grew in the circuses, you know, like this is like P.T. Barnum era, where you had hundreds of minstrels and then white and black minstrels against each other. I mean, this is it. And you can look at this stuff. It's bombastic. I can't even imagine what some of these shows must have looked like. I mean, I'm horrified to think of it, some of them. But
yeah, well, no, you're absolutely right. And, you know, it's hard. It's extremely hard, you know. Just to bring it a little bit modern, I remember the amount of white people who did not subscribe to and want Married with Children off the air. They wanted Roseanne off the air, mm-hmm. right? And shows like this. And then the Italian Americans, they wanted the Sopranos off the air. Okay. And then we could look, you know, and we could see the same thing in certain African American shows and the same thing in certain Latino shows. So I guess with all this being said, and there's a lot of history, and what I've come to the conclusion based on our conversation right now, this was a theater tech model that spawned into records, spawned into films, spawned into radio, spawned into television. Are we, as a collective, not you and I, are we taking this way too serious? Or you know, because it's like, I loved Archie Bunker growing up, and then I loved Maud, and I loved George Jefferson. But all of these people were saying some really harsh thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's what's tricky about this type of theater, is that at the end of the day, since it's based around masks, all the characters can take their masks off and then be something completely different. And that's what makes this type of entertainment always extremely confounding, because it really, at the end of the day, it's another mask. And that's one of the things that makes it so interesting to see how it's reverberated out there into the world. But of course, again, I always take it back to what I've really enjoyed about learning about the blues and its role in putting that final nail in the blackface minstrelsy, because of the realness, because the blues is always based on
I'm telling you just like it is. It's me and you one-to-one, and I'm telling you like it is, whether it's the guy talking about his woman or talking to his woman or talking to another man or whatever it may be, or telling an audience about the, what they think about the blues. You know, and that was ultimately what put the final nail in Blackface Minstrelsy. And I think that that's something that's amazing, something that's very, very amazing.
So is it safe to say that the blues is the expression that removed the mask?
Because before that, it was all composed music. And so now the blues is an improvised music where you don't have to follow a model or an archetype of a character. You could be the exact character that you are. And of course, that's something that everybody loves about the blues, even to this day.
Mm, I dig it. Man, we touched a whole bunch of things here that was very necessary. I believe you answered this several times over, but I do want to just specifically ask you this one last question.
Oh, sure.
With everything said, what is the legacy of Blackface and Minstrelsy on African-American traditional music and the Black experience?
That's a multifaceted one there. I mean, it's to me, I'll tell you the greatest thing is that I can read about it in a book and then I can close that book.
Mm.
That to me, that's progress. I'll just tell you that right off the bat. That's progress. If I can read about all this and then I can close the book and say, wow, I learned about it. It's like looking at the rings of a tree, you know?
Yes.
And it's like, and I try to keep myself removed if I get too wrapped up in it, because people did what they did, but it's good to know their stories, just like any other story. Like, you know, like, I don't know, everything from Harriet Tubman to Madam C.J. Walker or,
right,
you know, any other historical figure. Why not, wouldn't Burt Williams or James Reese Sheriff be just as interesting, or even Charlie Patton or Gus Cannon? They're people that lived it.
Right. So we wouldn't have to.
Exactly.
And, okay. Yeah. So yes, that I'm clear. So in closing, what we're saying is the history is very good to understand and know, and to be thankful we don't have to make those decisions.
Yep, that's the truth. I mean, a lot of people made those big decisions, and it's nice to be able to just keep on moving.
I totally understand, and I totally get it, man. I thank you again. This is how it's done.
Oh, Jack Dapper, it's always a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for having me.